Om sahana vavatu, sahano bhunaktu, sahavidyan karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti, shanti, shanti. Om. Good. Welcome back. Welcome also to the many students attending these classes online. We continue with a very powerful, this whole chapter is powerful. We said that this is really the Jnana Yoga chapter of the entire Uddhava Gita. And this particular section began with a very well crafted question by Uddhava, who asked Sri Krishna, if my true nature is Satchitananda, and if my body is just an inert thing, then where does suffering come from? Satchitananda Atma doesn't suffer, and the body isn't an insentient thing, so who suffers? Is his question, and a very good question. In our last class, can we have the verse, please? In our last class, we saw this verse. I'd like to see it again briefly, just to introduce today's classes. So Sri Krishna said, look at the last line. Api avivekinaha, avivekinaha. For an ignorant person, for someone who has not become enlightened, for such a person, go up a line, samsaraha, a life of worldly suffering, palavan continues to occur, it takes place, tavat, as long as, how long? Up at the top, yavat, as long as, you have to jump around here, atmanaha, for atma, for your true self, as long as there is sannikarshanam, the association. Association with what? Deha, indriya, pranaihi, along with your body, senses, and life energy. And that is an important teaching because it says the one who suffers is not Satchitananda Atma or the body. It's Satchitananda Atma and the body instead of A or B. Do you, any of you study Boolean algebra? It reminds me, it's not A or B, it's A and B, the combination of the two. A very simplistic example is your computer. Your computer has hardware and software, but hardware and software doesn't make your computer work unless it's plugged in and turned on. So there's another factor. In addition to hardware and software, you need electricity. And here, in addition to hardware, body, and software, mind and senses, you need the equivalent of energy, which is Atma. But that, I've said, is a simplistic metaphor. It's an overly simplistic metaphor. And the reason it's overly simplistic is that hardware, software, and electricity are all of the same level of worldly reality. And that's where this teaching of Advaita Vedanta is so remarkable. Notice that if Atma were brought down to the level of energy, some people do this, right? Atma is energy, the energy that makes you alive. Energy is a worldly thing. Professor Einstein, who lived down the road here, he knew a lot about energy. What did he know about Atma? Probably not too much. So My point is, Atma, to suggest in any way that Atma is some kind of energy, like the electricity for your computer, it drags Atma down to the level of the world, our level. If we refer to Atma as an inner divinity, oh, this is a funny metaphor. If Atma is the inner divinity, and the inner divinity is energy, then your stove in your kitchen is extremely divine because it's got burners on top and it's got an oven underneath. Look at all those sources of energy in your stove. You get my point? Atma is not energy because energy is a worldly reality. Atma is the inner divinity, and we'll be speaking more about that as we go along. Here, Sri Krishna hints at that by saying the ignorant person suffers a life of samsara. The word we skipped in the last line is apartaha api, even though it is unreal. And this is introducing today's topic. Hardware, software, and electricity are equally real. Body, mind, and Atma are not equally real. Very simple, very important. Body and mind are part of a worldly reality. Atma, your true nature, consciousness, is not a worldly reality. It's a fundamental reality. It's the so-called inner divinity. But here's the problem. An unenlightened person, apartaha api, even though the body and mind are not as real as you, your true nature, consciousness, even then that unenlightened person will suffer. And this point is going to be developed now in the coming verses, so let's see that development. Arte hyavidyamanepi, arte hyavidyamanepi, samsritir nani vartate, samsritir nani vartate, dhyayato vishayanasya, dhyayato vishayanasya, swapne nartagame yata, swapne nartagame yata. Artehi avidyamane api, even api, even though, arte avidyamane, even though the objects in the world are not as real as you. And this is going to be explained in this verse, just hold on. Even though objects in this world are you, then samsritihi na nivartate, samsriti means samsara, a life of worldly suffering. That life of worldly suffering na nivartate doesn't come to an end, it doesn't cease, even though stuff you experience every day is not as real as you are, it's real enough to make you suffer. At the end of the last class, I gave you the example of the rope snake you see in a dark alley. How real is that snake? Real enough to make you suffer, right? Is that as real as you are? And take you as your body. You're inside a body, you're walking down the alley. We'll say the rope is as real as your body. Is the snake as real as your body? No, but real enough to make you suffer. So here, Shankara. Wrong text, wrong day. All right. Sri Krishna says, dhyayataha vishayan asya. So for a person who goes on dhyayataha, not meditating, reflecting on these objects, considering the objects in the world, Vishayan, considering these objects in the world to be real, like considering the snake to be real, makes you suffer. If you knew the snake was an illusion, a play of your eyes, you wouldn't suffer. But considering the snake to be real, you suffer. Considering your angry boss to be real. If you really want to throw your boss off, you tell him that your spiritual teacher said he's not real. Be interesting to see what his response would be. My spiritual teacher has said, because you're not real, I don't have to be threatened by you. How's that? It'd be an interesting discussion you'd have with him. But this is what Sri Krishna is teaching, and now he gives the metaphor that we use consistently for this topic. It's the metaphor of a dream. Yatha, last line, yatha, just as swapne, in a dream, there is anartha agamaha. Agama, the coming of anartha, suffering. Suffering arises in a dream due to objects that aren't as real as you. The elephant that's chasing you in the dream, how real is that elephant? Again, real enough to make you suffer. And it doesn't take a real elephant is something you better take seriously, but even an unreal elephant is enough to make you suffer. That's what the dream metaphor is all about. Suppose you had, I've given this metaphor again, in fact, I'm sure the ancient rishis would have used this metaphor if they knew about lucid dreams. Apparently, they didn't know. They never made reference to it. Most of you know that a lucid dream is to be dreaming and know you're dreaming. It's like being half awake, half dreaming. So you're having a dream, but you know it's only a dream. So in a lucid dream, you would not consider the elephant to be as real as you, the dreamer. Notice I'm distinguishing between dream character and dreamer. In a normal dream, you are the dream. You are a dream character, right? You project yourself into a dream. By the way, let me just share with you an observation. Last night in a dream, I had an observation I've never made before, but maybe some of you have. I realized that the me in the dream was not the same as my waking personality. There were things about the me in the dream which didn't resemble me at all. I don't remember the details right now, but it was a version of me. It wasn't the actual me. There were some things that were different. That shows you how arbitrary self-identity is. You know, we have a concept of ourselves right here and now in the waking state that is so real. You know, we know. You know, you were born. You remember your parents. You remember where you were. You may not remember, but anyway. You were born in a certain place at a certain time. You remember your parents. You remember your childhood. You remember your youth. You remember your education. You remember all of these details of your life and all of the experiences you've undergone in your life. All of these experiences have led you to formulate in your mind a concept of who you are that is extremely real. Correct? How real is it if in a dream it doesn't persist? That was what I saw in last night's dream. It wasn't the waking Swami Tadatmananda who was a character in the dream. It was me but it didn't have my same history. It didn't have my... What was... It was... I have dreams we don't remember, but it was at an earlier stage in my life, in like 30s, I suppose, but I was working in a field that I didn't never worked. Right? Generally, if you dream about when you were, you know, working 30 years ago, you would imagine yourself in your former workplace. I imagine myself in some other place performing some kind of professional work that I had never done in my life. Please appreciate my point. If your identity as who I am is so real, shouldn't it persist in a dream? You would think so, since dreams are a product of our memories, right? Dreams are a product of memories. This is a pretty inaccurate memory. It never happened. I was never working in that kind of field. And the point, I'm hoping you're getting this, is how arbitrary our sense of identity is. We take it so real. This is who I am. Swami Tadatmananda is a teacher, a disciple of Swami Dayananda, and he had all these experiences through his life, and this and that and the other thing happened, and now he's teaching at an ashram he founded in New Jersey. That seems very real. It's arbitrary. Completely arbitrary. So whatever is your... Long ago I used this metaphor. We all have an autobiography in our heads. I like that. In your brain, in your mind someplace is an autobiography. Fine. Don't take it too seriously. Many people, by the way, many people who write either a resume or an autobiography, they always exaggerate. So you already get it that your autobiography in your mind is not as accurate as you think it is. It's your impression. It's something you composed. It's something you created. And there's a little bit of a side issue. It certainly relates here very clearly. But the importance of these comments is to help us loosen our grip on our concept of who we are. It's a construct. It is created by you. Notice someone, just one more example, and then we'll come back here. A good example of this is someone who's very accomplished, but has low self-esteem. You can imagine someone like that, or you may have had a point in your life where you felt that. You can be extremely accomplished, but what does it say in your autobiography? I am a loser. It says in your autobiography, if you have low self-esteem, in spite of your accomplishments, why does it say, I am a loser, in your autobiography? Who wrote that autobiography? That's the point. The autobiography we have in our heads is not a record of reality as it truly is. It's a record of our interpretation of reality. Most people would exaggerate on their CV or autobiography, but some people do the opposite. They denigrate themselves in their mental autobiography, and therefore, in spite of their accomplishments, they write, I am a loser, in their mental autobiographies. So, don't take it as a statement of fact. Whatever you feel yourself to be is a self-created impression which is subject to change. And being subject to change is a great thing, because along comes Sri Krishna and he wants to completely rewrite your autobiography. What he would do, if Sri Krishna were, I'm just having fun with this. This is a topic we've never discussed like this before. Suppose Sri Krishna was your editor. How would he edit your mental autobiography? Certainly, if you write, "I am a loser," he'd cross that off. If you write, "I am successful," he'd also cross that off. "I am a loser," red ink. "I am successful," red ink. And of course, editors like to write their suggestions in the margins. And what would Sri Krishna's correction be? "I am not a loser. I am not successful. I am Satchidananda Atma. I am the divinity of all. I am a manifestation of that divinity." That's what he would write in the margin. And when you can edit your own autobiography with the help of these teachings, that's it. That's enlightenment. Enlightenment, enlightenment in a funny way is to rewrite your mental autobiography. In a more serious way, if some of you have attended a class where mostly not this class, but our Vedanta class, where we've discussed that the result of enlightenment is not the destruction of the ego. Many people wrongly believe that it's ahankara nasha, the obliteration of the ego. Problem is, if your ego is obliterated and somebody says hello to you, how will you respond if you don't feel yourself to be an individual person, right? The ego is an organizational principle in our minds. It allows you to function as an individual. It allows you to relate to others. If you had no concept of who you were in the absence of ahankara, this is the wrong concept, and many people cling to this. You obliterate your ego, your sense of identity. So if you have no sense of who you are, how will you function in the world? Or if your sense of who you are is, "I am Satchidananda Atma," how does Satchidananda Atma go to Starbucks and order a coffee? Doesn't. You get my point. Ahankara is a crucial organizational principle in our minds. Our goal is not to erase it or obliterate it or destroy it. My guru's words are perfect. He said our goal is to have an enlightened ego. What is an enlightened ego? An enlightened ego is one that's not confused. An enlightened ego knows this is a body, this is a mind. This body-mind complex has a certain role in the world. It does certain things, it interacts with others, and it is a worldly reality that is fully accepted for what it is. This individual body-mind complex is absolutely accepted by that enlightened ego. The enlightened ego is not confused, though. The enlightened ego knows, "I am not this body-mind complex. I am Satchidananda Atma." So the enlightened ego continues to have a relationship with the body and mind, but not a relationship that's based on confusion and causing suffering. A confused ego identifies itself with the body and mind and suffers. A deconfused ego, is that a word? A deconfused ego is an ego that has, that recognizes the worldly reality of body and mind, but knows itself to be independent. So this, now I'll finish up my long, this is Sri Krishna hasn't said any of this, but it seemed like a good time to bring this up. Maybe it was the dream I had last night that's prompting this whole discussion. And to finish the discussion here, what Swami Dayananda called an enlightened ego means, is related to what I just described about rewriting the autobiography in your mind. When you write that autobiography in a state of confusion, how accurate will it be? When you write, I am a loser, how accurate is that? People do it. Even when you write, I am successful, that's better, of course, than, it's more accurate than I am a loser. So I am successful is more accurate, but it's still not completely accurate, right? Success belongs to the body-mind complex. Atma is neither successful nor a loser. Atma is divine. So when you cross off, I am a loser, when you cross off, I am successful, and when you make the correction, I am Satchitananda Atma, when you make that correction in your mental autobiography, that's enlightenment. That's the enlightened ego, as my guru called it. All of this is kind of hinged off of the problem of this dhyayatah vishayan, someone who considers objects to be as real as oneself, somebody who considers this body as real as I am, this mind is as real as I am, the entire world is as real as I am. Now you see why that computer metaphor is so defective. Software, hardware, and electricity are the same level of reality, but here, your true nature is like that of the dreamer. So, oh, that's where we hinged off. The lucid dream. You have to, if you, this is the trick. If you go off on a detour, you have to find your way back. And I have to tell you, my guru, Pujya Swamiji, was famous for his detours. And perhaps more famous for finding his way back. He always managed very nicely to pick up the thread. So as we're picking up our thread here, we talked about the lucid dream. That lucid dream, to see the elephant in your dream and know it's just a dream elephant. That lucid you in the dream is not it's not a dream character. You're identified with the dreamer. That's exactly where we got off on this tangent. When you are identified with the dreamer, I'm sorry, when you're identified with the dream character, the you projected into the dream, that you projected into the dream is as real as a dream elephant, right? That elephant can trample the dream character. Have you ever been, how many times have you died in your dreams? That's not an uncommon dream. And yet here we sit. Thank goodness it was only the dream character that dies in a dream after dream after dream. But in a lucid dream, you're not identified with the dream character. You are identified as being the dreamer. You're having a dream, but you know you are the dreamer. And why should a dreamer be afraid of a dream elephant? The dreamer knows he or she is more real than the dream elephant. Now, this leads us to a very profound teaching of Advaita Vedanta, and I'd like to bring it up because this, in the first line, he says, "Arte he of he indeed, or because arte avidyamane, because or api, even though arte objects in the world avidyamane." Now, avidyamane would typically be described as non-existent. Are objects in the world non-existent? Would you be afraid of a non-existent elephant? If in front of our altar was standing a huge non-existent, how do you describe a non-existent elephant as being huge? I don't know. I'm taking a lot of liberty here to make a point. If there were a huge non-existent elephant in front of the altar, would any of you feel afraid? Of course not. If you walk down that alley, would the non-existent snake bother you? If you only saw a rope, would you be afraid of the snake? So that which is utterly non-existent doesn't cause any problems. What causes a problem is confusion. Confusion wherein you attribute more reality to something than it deserves. You attribute reality to that snake, it's threatening. You attribute reality, go back to the funniest story. You attribute absolute reality to your boss, and your boss becomes threatening. You attribute complete reality to your body. When your body has some physical affliction, that becomes threatening. When you attribute complete reality to your mind and thoughts, it becomes threatening. Remember, our definition of absolute reality is that which doesn't change. Consciousness is a fundamental reality. It doesn't change. The consciousness present in your experience right now through the teachings of Vedanta is discovered to be an unchanging consciousness, a fundamental reality. This isn't a matter of belief. It's not a doctrine. It's something you have to personally discover. When you have personally discovered that consciousness, the consciousness present in this experience, is utterly unchanging, it's a fundamental reality, then anything which is less real will not be so threatening. Your boss is changing his or her mood every day. How real is your boss? How real is your body, which goes on changing? How your thoughts and emotions are changing moment to moment. None of it is as real as your essential conscious nature. This is to suggest how you become enlightened. You become enlightened by rewriting that autobiography when you can cross off, I am a loser. When you can cross off, I am successful. And when you can cross off, when you can write in place, I am unchanging consciousness. How dramatically everything changes. Okay, that's enough. Our class is going quickly here. Let's see some verses.
Yatha hyaprati buddhasya. Yatha hyaprati buddhasya. Praswapo bhakhvanartha brita sa eva prati buddhasya sa eva prati buddhasya navai mohaya kalpate Navai Mohaya Kalpate.
There's something wonderful in this verse, and that is it. Every word in it has a double meaning. You can read this verse in two completely different ways. So he's talking about one yatha, just as one who is a pratibuddha. Now, Buddha, by the way, the Buddha, you look it up in a dictionary, the first meaning in the dictionary is awakened. Buddha, first definition, awakened. So pratibuddha, completely awakened. A pratibuddha, completely asleep. So a pratibuddhasya, for one who is deeply sleeping, one who is praswapaha, dreaming nicely in your comfortable bed. Your bed may be comfortable, but bahu anartabrit, your dreams are filled with bahu, many anartas, many. We have nice dreams too, but sometimes they're not so nice. So we have anartabrit, means filled with many incidents of instances of suffering. So someone who is sleeping soundly and dreaming, in their dreams they have suffering again and again and again. As we joked about before, you can die in your dream again and again and again. How fun is dying? Not much. You can die several times in a single dream. Our dreams are such. But pratibuddhasya, for the one who wakes up completely. The dream is over. Pratibuddhasya, for one who wakes up, sa bahu anartabrut, that dream filled with suffering, eva indeed, that dream filled with navai mohaya kalpate, mohaya, due to moha, due to confusion, due to taking the confusion you had while dreaming, na kalp, kalpate, how's our Sanskrit? Kalpate governs the dative. Namohaya kalpate. It is not possible to have that nakalpate. It is not possible, mohaya, to have that delusion, pratibuddhasya, for one who has woken up. Now, this is kind of obvious. You are subject to suffering due to your dreams when you are sleeping. And when you wake up out of your dreams, then what? You may have been trampled by that elephant several times. And when you wake up, you find that you're in pretty good shape. So this is what it is, how significant to wake up. That's one meaning. Go back. We're going to take the whole verse again. It's not that long. So taking the verse in a second way, yata, just as he, indeed, a pratibuddhasya. So Buddha, the first meaning, was awakened from sleep. One of the other meanings is enlightened, which is why Buddha, the Buddha is called Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, gets called Buddha. Buddha is actually more of a title. It's become his name, but Buddha can also mean enlightened. So, one who is pratibuddha is one who is completely enlightened. One who is a pratibuddha is one who is completely a blockhead. So that blockhead, bahu anartabrit praswapaha. Praswapaha, that blockhead encounters or experiences the dream of life. The dream of life. When you woke up this morning, I'm sorry, when you dreamt of waking up this morning, having your morning tea or coffee, you dreamt of getting dressed, getting ready, getting into your car, driving to our Shabodha Center, and right now you are dreaming. This is a metaphorical dream. This is the dream of ignorance. Like when you take the dream world to be absolutely real, if you take this world to be absolutely real, it's also a mistake. The dream world is less real than this world, but this world is less real than unchanging consciousness. Can I say that one more time? Dream world is less real than this world, but this world is less real than you, your essential nature, as unchanging consciousness. But one who is a pratibuddha, one who is a so-called blockhead, doesn't get it and takes this world as being absolutely real and therefore suffers. On the other hand, in the third line, pratibuddhasya now means one who is enlightened. One who is enlightened, for that person, sa eva bahu anartam, all of the suffering that was there prior to enlightenment, it navai mohaya kalpate, it is not possible to be deluded like you were previously in the state of ignorance. So just as you wake up out of a dream, and any suffering associated with the dream goes in the same way. When you wake up out of the so-called dream of ignorance, notice I said so-called. This is not a dream. It's a metaphor we use. So when you wake up out of the metaphoric dream of ignorance, all this suffering comes to an end. Okay, we'll see one more verse. Yeah.
Shoka harsha bhaya krodha, shoka harsha bhaya krodha, lobha moha sprahadayaha, lobha moha sprahadayaha, ahankarasya drishyante, ahankarasya drishyante, janma mrityushcha natmanaha, janma mrityushcha manaha.
Okay, so what is written in your mental autobiography? All the experiences of your life are written in your mental autobiography. What kind of experiences? Like shoka, sadness, written in your autobiography. Harsha, elation, also written in your autobiography. Bhaya, fear. Krodha, anger. Lobha, desire. Moha, delusion. Spriha, longing. Adayaha, etc. By the way, your autobiography in your mind, is it just one or two pages long? You've written a tome, hundreds and hundreds of pages, in which your self-concept, that construct, is defined. Your self-image is comprised of those hundreds and hundreds of pages of self-definition. Who owns? What a funny question. Who owns that mental autobiography? Well, an autobiography belongs to the person who did all the actions, right? So who did all those actions? Well, Atma doesn't do anything, right? Unchanging consciousness doesn't do anything. Therefore, that autobiography, Sri Krishna says, na atmanaha, in the last line, he says, it doesn't belong to Satchidananda Atma. Because Atma doesn't do anything. If Atma doesn't do anything, imagine writing an autobiography. Imagine writing an autobiography for a rock. No, it can't be autobiography. You are hired to write a biography for a rock. Ghostwriter, good. You are ghostwriting the autobiography. Of course, if you go back a billion years, you can actually come up with a biography, but at least in your lifetime, what does that rock do? Does it wake up in the morning and go to sleep at night? No. Does it go anywhere? No. Does it do anything? No. So what if you are the ghostwriter of the rock's biography, autobiography, what will you write? Be one blank page. How does that compare to your autobiography? So this is the point. Consciousness is not engaged in action. Consciousness reveals everything you do. We've used the word sakshi, awareful witness. The significance of that term, sakshi is not involved. Sakshi is an uninvolved observer. In this context, Atma can be called an uninvolved observer. Uninvolved meaning not affected by what you observe. That's in this context, that's a fine way, that's a good way to understand Atma. But then, if Atma is an uninvolved observer who's not affected by what's being observed, meaning Atma is unchanging consciousness, then that autobiography, na atmanaha, cannot belong to Atma. Then, to whom does that autobiography belong? Ahankarasya drishyante. It is drishyante. All the pages of those of your autobiography in your head, drishyante, are seen deep to belong to ahankara, ego, in the sense of you identified with your body and mind. Jiva, the individual person. Remember, we've defined the individual person, jiva, as a composite entity, body, mind, and consciousness. That composite entity also has this this composite entity has a feeling of being I, right? So you have a body, you have a mind, you have consciousness, and you also have a sense that I am me. That I am me is a very simple way of describing the technical term ahankara. Ahankara is feeling like I am me. Who owns that autobiography? The I who says, I am me. That ahankara owns that autobiography. That autobiography, which might be poorly written, you know, I am a loser, but even if that autobiography says, I am successful, there's still a lot of shoka in that autobiography. There's still a lot of bhaya, fear, in that autobiography. There's still a lot of krodha in that autobiography. A lot of lobha, a lot of moha, delusion, a lot of spriha, longing, adayaha, etc. There's, you know, if you write an honest autobiography, half of it will be wonderful, half of it will be suffering. Doesn't that kind of describe our lives? Both. It's all up and down and up and down. So you'll find lots of wonderful things in that autobiography, but a lot of suffering in that autobiography. And if you have not yet rewritten that autobiography by crossing off I am a loser, by crossing off I am successful, and writing instead I am Satchidananda Atma, I am unchanging consciousness, if you have not yet done that, meaning if you're not yet enlightened, you are subject to more and more suffering. It's inevitable. It's guaranteed that you are going to experience more suffering. Experience more suffering how? He says, janma mrityuhu cha. Because in addition to the shoka, harsha, all the stuff in the first line, he says that you are going to continue being subject to things like mrityu, death. That can't be fun. So dying and all other forms of suffering. And then when you die and you're not enlightened, what follows is rebirth. And when you're reborn, are you reborn enlightened? No. So then you suffer in your next life. You die unenlightened. You get reborn. You suffer. You die. Suffer. Die. Samsara. Suffer, die, suffer, die, suffer, die. Wouldn't it be nice to get out of that? That's what this is all about. So how do you get out of that suffer, die cycle? By recognizing the truth of who you are is the consciousness by whom this experience right now is known. And with the help of these teachings, by discovering that the consciousness present in your experience right now is not ordinary, you may think it's ordinary, but it in fact is extraordinary. Consciousness, your consciousness, is not affected by the nonsense happening in your mind. Your consciousness is not affected by the problems of your boss, of your body. Anticipating my next line, your consciousness is not afflicted by your angry boss. Your consciousness is not afflicted by anything. Your consciousness, further, is not stuck inside your body. Your consciousness has no edge, has no limit, has no boundary. It is all pervasive, it is full, it is complete. When you discover your true nature, to be that unchanging consciousness, then you can take your autobiography. By the way, since it's so long, there's an easier way to edit that 800-page autobiography in your head, and that is simply add an appendix, an afterword. And in that appendix or afterword, you simply said, everything I've just written belongs to my ego. My true nature is Satchidananda Atma. How would you put that one page as an appendix to your autobiography? Notice then it doesn't erase that whole autobiography because it belongs to someone. Who does it belong to? Individual person. But who are you? You are not identical to that individual person who owns the other 800 pages of that autobiography. You are the one described on the 801st page. Everything written above here belongs to my ahankara, ego. I am Satchidananda Atma. So you need that afterword. And that's what these teachings culminate in. That's what my guru called an enlightened ego. This is a good place to stop. We'll continue next week. Tomorrow we have our Vedanta class at 10 o'clock and satsang at 11. It might snow tonight. So if you're coming tomorrow, please check for a cancellation email before you leave the house. So certainly by 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning, there'll be a cancellation email sent out if the class is indeed canceled. We'll conclude with our prayers. Om Ganana Han Twa Ganapatigam Avamahe Kavinga Vinam Hupamashravastamam Jeshtarajam Brahmanam Brahmanas Patahana Shrenvan Uttavasira Sadhanam Om Mahaganapataye Namaha Ishvaro Gurur Hatmeti Murti Bheda Vibhagine Vyoma Vad Vyapta Dehaya Dakshina Murtaye Namaha Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsachanura Mardanam Devaki Paramhanandam Krishnam Vande Jagat Gurum Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah Sarve Santu Niramayah Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhag Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya, om shanti shanti shanti, om tat sat.